So listen, here we are. I hope this works.
I hope this works too. This has been a day already.
Let's... Yeah, talk to me about, I mean, it's been a month for me. It's been a day for you. It's been, no, it's been a year for you. I listen,
right. I get a lumbar support. I'm really...
You need it. You need it. Get it, girl. I support that fully. Hey, Quinn.
So
you're doing,
you know,
great.
What I feel like,
hey,
right,
you're
now?
Doing,
do you
great.
Know what I feel like?
Tell me
Can
what
I
you feel
tell
like?
What I feel like?
Please.
I feel like Griffin. I got, he went to school. He went to school this week, and for St. Patrick's Day, they gave him a sheet to fill out that said, I am lucky because, and then they write down what you say. And his came back and said, I am lucky because I don't know.
I saw that just now before we started.
So
I cackled,
depressing, right?
And I was like, that kid's got some ennui. He's and like, I love it.
I don't know.
I feel lucky because I don't know. I'm here. I'd rather be with my family.
And I'm like channeling that energy right now.
You know, Quinn, yeah, like I feel... Listen, I love this because I think we're both meeting here in this space, which means I tell you, I do think that there's something going on in the world right now.
Okay.
I don't think
there
it's just
be,
us.
Better not just be me.
Yeah, Quinn's like,
what's
enough.
What's going on with you?
Enough. Absolutely enough.
Why am I lucky? I don't know.
I feel like maybe
That's
it's just
I'm
me,
feeling.
But can your mother come at a better time right now?
Well, I will say that I'm on a parent's WhatsApp with all the kids in Koa's class, and that today it's blowing up with people saying that they kept their kids home because they had diarrhea and barfed last night. So I'm like, and Koa woke up and went, oh, my stomach hurts as hell. And I was like, your stomach hurts as hell? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, do you want to not go to school? And he's like, I'm okay. And I was like, all right. So he's in school. His stomach hurts as hell.
His stomach hurts as hell, but he's in school. You know what? He's got to keep calm and carry
that
on.
Kid.
I
love that
Quinn,
kid.
I kind of am loving how we're entering this space of our recording because I think, listen, it sounds like overwhelmed is the theme of the day, and that's okay.
That's okay.
And that's okay.
That's okay.
That's okay.
It's like, yeah, something truly has been in the air. I will say that it was Adam's birthday last week, and I was meant to make him a carrot cake for his birthday. And I was like, I know what carrot cake I want to make.
Five stars,
this
New York Times.
Five stars, New York Times. Thank you. And then I was on a text thread with friends and they were like, no. This is the carrot cake you should make. And they sent me and they were like, she's really good. And I was like, but this cake looks good. And they were like, let me see. No. Keep in mind, I'm making the carrot cake, so it's a little.
I know, but is this the closest friend chat? If it's the closest friend chat, you're absolutely screwed. You're screwed when it comes to cooking. The closest friend chat is legitimately the definition of too many cooks in the kitchen.
Too many bullies in the text field. So they were like, no, you're not going to make that carrot cake. You're going to make this carrot cake because we like that it has whatever, cloves. I don't know. Pecans. So I was like, all right, fine, I'll make that carrot cake. And they're like, it'll be fine. There's a video. I buy all the ingredients. I sit down to watch the video and I realize this is a carrot cake recipe for someone that's going to make a three-layer cake. So like essentially having three cake pans in the oven, making three different cakes that you move to and fro. And I was like, hold up. And I realized this like day of, and because I have all the ingredients and I'm like, I can't make a three-layer carrot cake. I don't have a cake pan. I have one cake pan. It's a spring form. I don't have three fucking cake pans. So I was like, what the fuck am I going to do? And they were like, and I was like, should I do cupcakes? Maybe I should just do cupcakes. And they were like, no, you're doing a cake. Do the spring form pan. And I was like, okay.
Oh, cool.
Then I go
that
to do this
so
recipe.
Nervous for the spring form
and
pan.
And the recipe is I can't even tell you, the recipe is so long that this was from Braden's cookbook. And so I'm calling his boyfriend, Tom, to send me pictures of the recipe. And he's like, here it is. And then I'm like, great. And then I get to the bottom and I'm like, oh, I just realized the frosting is a whole other recipe in the book. Can you send that to me? And he's like, yes. So he sends me the other recipe. Then I get to the bottom. I'm in the middle of cooking and I get to it and I'm like, why does it end here? And then I'm like, it's a 2-page recipe. So I call Tom back and I'm like, it's a 2-page recipe. And he's like, stop texting me. And I'm like, I just am going to need you to keep sending me pictures of this cookbook that you have.
Did he say, stop texting me?
Yes. And so then he sent me the other picture and it said you had like a cup and a half of chopped pecans or something. But so fine, you buy a cup and a half of chopped pecans. Then this is what she says, divide that into threes. Here's what you do. A third of them should be diced really fine. Quinn, a third Quinn, toasted. Quinn. A third ground up into powder. It's that kind of recipe.
Fuck and you're off. Like,
fuck you. And like all day, this carrot cake took like 4.5 hours. It was my whole day was making this carrot cake. And so then I like was done making it. I made the kids' cupcakes with some of the batter and the frosting because I was like, I want to try it. And I also want the kids to try it and be able to decorate cupcakes. And they were like, Mama, it's so good. And I was like, you know what? It is so good. That was a lot of hard work.
Oh, it was. It worked out well. I just like imagined gorgeous. With like how you're feeling. It would just like, it failed miserably. No, it was well, delicious. Well,
the story's not over. Oh, I'm so sorry to say.
No.
So I did then go to the birthday carrot cake in hand, knowing how delicious it was. And we went to cut into it that came out of the springform pan. The center was not cooked. So it was like raw in the middle carrot cake.
Quinn.
Totally cooked and perfect on the outside ring.
Quinn.
But it was my own fault because I didn't follow the recipe and make a 3-layer carrot cake. Anyway, that's the story of me making carrot cake.
That sounds like a lot.
And I'll never do it again.
I'm so sorry. And I learned my lesson. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
It was the same week that Braden came over to babysit. And he and Tom were going to watch a movie and watch the kids. And I said, great. And they brought over a bottle of wine and we opened it and we drank some before we were leaving all together. And then I remembered that there was some wine in the fridge that I wanted to throw out because it was wine you had left.
Yeah.
And it had been like a long time where I was like, there's not that much in it, but I know it's too old to drink. Yeah. And I don't want the boys going in and pouring themselves this rancid wine and having a sick surprise. So I'm like, you know, trying to get ready to go, putting on my like lipstick, running into the kitchen. I grab the bottle, I open it, you know, it's already open. So I know it's the one. I dump it in the sink and then I look at it because it dumped for longer than I thought.
It's
and
the
I'm
one
like,
that you just
Chardonnay.
Bought.
I don't think Carrie would have bought Chardonnay.
I didn't buy Chardonnay.
I said, and I knew that Braden liked Chardonnay. And I said, Braden, did you bring a second bottle of wine? And he goes, yeah, I just opened it, the Chardonnay. And I was like, so I have to go now, but I did just dump that out for you into my sink. Have fun with the kids. So depressing,
Quinn,
for everyone involved.
Quinn, that's dark. It sounds like you've had some
I'm
dark
just
times.
Having a hard Yeah, Quinn, it's not my month.
Quinn, I feel the same way. It's not been my month either. I've bitten a little more than my mouth can hold. Frankly, my mouth is masticating.
More raw carrot cake than your mouth wants to chew?
It's not raw. It's dry and it's crumbly. And I have chipmunk cheeks and I don't have enough saliva to masticate it. That's how I feel. That's how I feel. By the way, I have to tell you, my mom listened to the episode where you and I had that tough conversation. And she was like, it made me really uncomfortable. And I just have to, and I think, I don't know, have you gotten feedback about that?
Yeah, I think somebody else wrote us and said it made them uncomfortable.
It said like they felt like we were in a fight. And I was like, I think, and my cousin was there and she was like, no, I actually really liked it because I think it's like a valuable conversation.
Lucy said she liked it. My friend said she liked it too.
I think it's all valuable. Like I think, but I just want to say, because it's been a minute, but we're good, guys. We're actually good. So don't worry about us.
It'd be so weird. We don't make any money doing this. It'd be so weird if we were bad and we were doing this. Like, you'll know when we're not good because there won't be an episode.
But here's the thing. Right now, like last week, I accidentally scheduled it for the wrong day and I like worked so hard. So we were good then too. It was just a date error. And it's because, like I said, I was masticating something and I couldn't chew it up properly. That's that. That's actually what happened. So it sounds like you're overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed. Hey, dearest listeners, dearest readers, are you overwhelmed? If so, you're not alone. We're going to get through this together. I love you all.
And we're going to do you a favor to balance out how overwhelmed you feel. And we're going to give you a really underwhelming episode. Be prepared. Mediocrity is just around the corner. It will feel so comfortable.
That's so like good. A lukewarm That's so tea. Good. Joke's on you, suckers.
Like a raw carrot cake, we are here to disappoint.
I'm just so sad.
We're a glass of Chardonnay, but it's in the sink.
It's like you can actually, from what your life has looked like, you can do an Alanis Morissette verse. Like when somebody asks how you're lucky and you say, I don't know.
No.
When you make a 4.5 hour carrot cake.
I can't let the carrot cake go.
It's really good. Anyway, I think you're living Alanis Morissette.
Annoying.
But you listen, enough complaining. Let's get to the real drama.
Enough.
AKA, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily.
I'm Quinn LePosner.
And I'm Carrie Ipama. And here we are.
And we'd like to thank... Is that a real name?
Oh, Dahmer was hungry?
Oh. No, we already did that. This okay, here's what, here where we're at. We're going to thank... Because I got faith, faith, the faith, faith.
Because I got a faith, the faith, the faith,
the faith, the faith. Because yeah. Now we got a faith, the faith, the faith. And faith is with us, yeah. She's got faith in us. She's not gonna pass us by. She's gonna join the club and get high off of life.
I think that's great. By the way, we've heard some feedback. People don't like the Patreon songs. I don't know what to tell you. It is what it is. Let's move on.
Oh, really? Somebody said they didn't like the songs? I'm shocked.
It feels like I don't know. They don't know what they're listening to.
But are you deaf?
They're like, no, but I wish I was.
You're about to be. Because we're going to thank Stacia. We're getting on your Casey-a because we know that you are
a famous-ia person to know, and we adore you so because Stacia, it's all good in ya,
in your body and in your name. I hope you always stay the same. Sweating bullets. Should we do one more?
Yeah, why not?
Save it for next time.
No, we're here. Let's do it.
We're here, but this has gotten quite queer. All right, let's say thank you to Corey W.
Corey W, a star is born. Corey W, you like corny stuff. That's why you listen to our show, because it's a little corny. Are you horny for more murder shows? And we are here because you love it so. And Corey W, let's party.
That was so good.
Did you like it?
Oh my God. That was really good.
Thank you.
I couldn't believe you came in with that. I had nothing left to give, and then you came in with that fucking gem.
I didn't think it was that good.
Work of art.
Oh my God, I have to tell you, Quinn, I've been doing no brags, but okay, here's actually some fun news. We've been doing BBC radio interviews for 6 chick flicks.
Oh, cool.
BBC. What is the place we did? We did BBC.
BBC One. Should we do it?
BBC Two.
BBC Three,
BBC Four,
BBC Five,
BBC Six,
BBC Seven,
BBC Heaven,
BBC Heaven.
So we did 2 radio interviews, and it's so funny because KK and I are on separate parts of the continent. That is of the North American variety.
Heard of it.
And so we're in these interviews and it's radio and it's so stressful because you're Zooming, but you don't see anybody's face and they're like asking you questions. I don't know how I sounded, but I think I sounded like an idiot, but hopefully it sells some tickets. So that's great.
People like idiots. If there's anything we know about this country, it's that people like idiots.
Well, this is so in the UK. Does the UK like idiots?
Oh, unfortunately, less so.
It's less so.
Not as much their thing.
Here's the really cool thing is that, have you heard of the publication, The Evening Standard?
Yes. I feel like when you said that, my mind instantly went to the movie Lady and the Tramp. So I don't know.
Well, they reached out to us and they're like, we want to help promote the London show. And so they're asking us to write a column. So we just started writing a column, which is very exciting.
talk about underqualified.
I know, right?
I love it.
Good for you.
Thanks.
I'm published in the Evening Standard.
We really need to sell some tickets in the UK. I think by the time this episode comes out, I will be mid-UK tour, which is so scary to think about.
So comforting.
Is it comforting? I don't
think. Things will be better for you there.
I need time to stand still. I need, because I have so much to do. We're like making contracts right now for our stage management team. It's so crazy.
That is crazy.
I'm really underqualified. If only they know it's all words and there's nothing to back it up with. I'm underqualified in literally everything that I'm doing. But I realize, I think everybody is underqualified in what they're doing.
So true.
It's so crazy.
It's just the person that walks in the room and is like, I can do that, that gets the job. So just keep faking it till you make it to.
I know, because it really, I mean, listen, I think we should take that as a lesson, because here we are with a true crime podcast. We have no business. We don't know what the fuck we're doing.
Do you know how long it took me to figure out how to get input output on my computer today, folks? Like an embarrassing amount of time. We're probably out of time. In fact, you don't get any stories. Goodbye.
Thanks. It did take a while, but you know what? We won't malign the husband, Matt. We won't malign him. I think he's working hard. He's trying hard. I know he...
Speak for yourself. He left one broccoli in the fridge.
You did?
Oh my God, he's here. He heard his name. He could hear his name through the computer and ran into the room to see what the ruckus was about.
Did you know that he was there
the whole
time? He did
leave one broccoli in the fridge. No, I didn't. He really snuck in. He's
that
like,
that was so sneaky. I thought it was a bit. You didn't know. He's always wrong, so you can never talk shit about him. But he did leave. Quinn just sent me, this is what I love. Quinn just sent me a picture, a single picture of a...
She knows what it is.
I know what it is. It's a single picture of a bag of broccoli with one floret left just sitting there. Rage.
A classic Matt McCroskey move.
It's like, was he like, no, you know what? I couldn't possibly eat the last one.
I can't get into his head about what the fuck anybody... It's that is the mind of a serial killer, quite frankly. I would love to hear what the woman you're touring with thinks about a man that leaves one floret in the bag.
Because
I bet she'd be like, get out while you can. Because you're dead.
Because you're D-E-A-D dead.
Who goes first today? Not to be nosy.
Well, it's an odd one, so you are.
Good. I'll do the really depressing one I have so that there's no way you can beat it and it'll end with something a little less horrible.
I think that's fair.
We're talking trigger warnings for sad days. Stuff okay. That happens to kids. Okay.
Ooh.
This I got from Inside Edition, Wikipedia, The Sun, and a really, really, really good book that I do recommend by our friend Anne Rule. Mm. The name of the book is Small Sacrifices.
Oh, no. I already don't like the name. With the trigger warning with the name, that's really bad.
So if you know, you know. Get out while you can. Because these kids couldn't. Diane Downs was born in Phoenix. I'm going to Phoenix in a couple of weeks for a wedding.
Really exciting stuff.
All you really need to know that are facts are that her dad was like super strict and the mom was one of those moms that was like, what dad says goes. She wasn't going to get in his way. If he was upset, the whole family had to be upset. And
okay,
I will say this. A lot of the book talks about her account of the fact that she was sexually abused when she was a child by her father. And really specific incidences are spoken about where one time he had her shirt off and they're in the car and some cop pulls him over and she's crying and puts her shirt back on and the cop sees and like scares the dad. There's all these really specific accounts. But what one thing you will also come to learn about Diane Downs is we can't really get too far into what she's accused anybody of because she is unfortunately what we might call an unreliable narrator.
Okay.
So she has recanted allegations about the sexual abuse. Her parents never said, yes, it happened. So we're just going to put it off to the side, even though when we're dealing with her psychology, it might be worth looking into.
Okay.
Let's just say she was raised in a home that was very strict, very conservative. And after high school, she enrolls in the Pacific Coast Baptist Bible College in Orange, which is where my sister lives. This doesn't sound fun. Like, it doesn't sound like a fun college experience, but she tries to make it really fun. And by a really fun, I just mean that she gets expelled.
Oh, okay.
She gets she gets expelled for promiscuous behavior.
Oh, she it's a Bible really school, y'all. She was really trying to have fun with a
just
capital
trying
F.
to have a good time.
Okay.
She likes men a lot. A lot. That is a truth. She likes the men and she likes to find friendships and otherwise with them.
Physical fun friendships. There's another F word we're leaving.
Fornication.
Out. Fornication. That's not the F word I was happening. Thinking. Okay, that one.
Okay.
That's the one that was.
Sure. So speaking of, I can't all her trysts and dalliances and
also,
liaisons.
Also, frankly, at this time, at this time, I'm kind of like, good for her. Go off. Go off.
Yes, although, we're at that part of the story. I tell you, she's in it for Diane. Diane is in it for Diane. She does run away from home and get married to Stephen Daniel, high school sweetheart. He's not really around a lot because he's in the Navy. She doesn't love that. She wants to feel loved. She wants to feel needed. What's the fastest way? Babies. He's not totally down because they don't have a lot of money, but she makes it happen regardless. And they have their first child, Christy Ann. And when they don't have a lot of money and then she gets pregnant again, he's like, what are you doing? Not happy at all. And she's has another little girl. And then she does go ahead and get pregnant a third time. He gets so pissed at this point that he's like, you got to get an abortion. She's like, okay. Later, she will regret making that decision because she'll come across some pro-life papers mm-hmm. that freak her out.
Well, like, she has a big. It wasn't her decision alone.
Right. Well, then he makes the right decision if you're a person that doesn't want children and you are a man, he gets a vasectomy.
Yeah, it's like takes two to tango, guy.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
Should have done it. But of course, once he gets the vasectomy, she's like, I think I'm going to seduce a guy so I can get pregnant. And does. And she has a third child, Stephen Daniel, who's born in 1979. So now it's 1979. She has three kids. They're making like $20,000 a year. Their house is not in great shape. Their marriage is not in great shape. They're fighting all the time physically. And one day she's watching the boob tube. You will come to find that Diane is not mother of the year. She like ignores the kids a lot and tries to,
I kind of got that vibe. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
She's a narcissist.
She's watching Donahue though. She's watching Donahue and it's a show about surrogates. And she's like, oh my God, I do love being pregnant. And I would love to give a woman the gift of this. So she applies to become a surrogate and calls the abortion she had on the application a miscarriage. And then they're like, she seems great. She's so perfect for this.
Yeah.
Let's psychologically test her. And the doctor's like, something is up with this woman. I don't know, but she rubs me wrong. Let's get some more tests done. Clinical psychologists come in and are like, she's very smart, but there's something here that is, I don't know. It's consistent with, but not totally diagnostic of major psychopathology. Like something's really akimbo here. And she gets examined by another psychologist who's like, wow, this woman can shut down her emotions at will. Can turn off emotions on her body like a light switch. Again, not mother of the year here. She hits her kids. She yells at them. She leaves them alone for long periods of time. But somehow she does get the go-ahead. She goes through enough weird hoops that she and lies so much that they're like, okay, you can be a surrogate. I can't totally picture how that happened.
Wow. They just like kept kicking the can until someone approved
her.
Like so any one of those people
that's
could have
exactly
been like,
right. That's
no.
exactly right.
But it feels like they probably were all desperate for a surrogate.
Yeah. And so she's like pregnant, but she's not taking care of her own kids. Her little girl, Cheryl, is in kindergarten and she only has a half day at her school. So she gets done at noon and then Diane is a postal worker. She's out delivering mail. And Cheryl just goes home after kindergarten, is alone by herself all day. She's five. Like, it's really wild.
Yeah, I'm not excusing that. Obviously, that's really messed up. But I do think, like, the 70s and 80s were, like, a very different time in how kids.
Yeah, you're right. Like, latchkey kids was a thing.
Was a thing.
But Stephen, who's not a good dad, will be like, oh, Diane was a terrible parent. She treated our kids like crap.
Okay. Like, yeah. I mean, I figured, like, none of that.
They eventually break up, of course, because that marriage was wacky tabacky, and she really likes a guy she works at the postal, her post office. His name is Robert Knickerbocker. He's married. Diane doesn't care. In fact, she's always kind of had the thing for married men. So she's really focused on trying to get Robert to leave his wife, Charlene. Like, that's her main focus. And even though she's had all these dalliances with other men, this guy, she really fucking eagle eye focuses in on. She really likes him. And one of the things they keep coming up against, other than the fact that he's married, is that Diane has all these kids. And he's always like, that's not, I don't want to be somebody's dad. Not interested.
Right. Right.
She does end up moving from Arizona to Oregon. And she is like, you're going to come with me. And I almost, her parents are there. So that's probably part of the move, that she now needs help. But she really wants him to leave his wife and come to Oregon, and they're pen pals. Well, they're all right. She's writing a lot of letters and making a lot of phone calls and trying to woo Robert to leave his wife.
Right.
Meanwhile, he's really glad she's gone because the temptation is gone. He tells his wife everything. She knows about the affair. She knows about it on a level where Diane will call her house to speak to Robert, and Charlene will give him the phone. She'll be like, it's Diane. It's that woman you cheated on me with. I don't know. We don't even have time to get into how weird Robert and Charlene's relationship is or isn't.
You know, but let them live. Let them live. Yeah. Ugh. Oh, no. Charlene is the one who's the mom. Diane is his wife.
Diane, no. Opposite.
No. Charlene and him, I'm not worried about Charlene and Robert. I'm not worried about them.
We don't need to worry about them.
I'm more worried about Diane.
We do need to worry about Diane's obsession with Robert, because she is writing these letters, these love letters, these
opuses,
terrible poems. They're opuses, they're poetry. They're coming back, return to sender. She gets very stalky.
Yeah.
And on May 19th, 1983, she arrives at the Mackenzie Willamette Hospital. The nurses that are there on duty hear honking and screaming outside. And when they run out, she's at her car and she's like, my three kids have been shot.
Oh, no.
She explains that to them. And I would say that saying that she explains it, explain is the right word, because even though she's pale and serious, she's not crying. She's not screaming. She's not frantic. She's very matter of fact.
Oh, no.
They notice there are two kids in the back seat and one in the front passenger. And they basically rush to get these kids inside to try to save their lives. The little girl that's in the front seat, Cheryl, they try to suction her throat because it's full of blood, but they just keep hitting clot after clot, and she isn't, the heartbeat is gone. She's not breathing, and she dies at 7 years old.
Oh.
They turn their focus to the two children that remain. Danny, Stephen Daniel, Danny, age 3, who is in bad shape, and Christy, age 8. Danny is for sure going to be paralyzed just from where he was shot. Christy has already had a stroke. They're barely alive. The hospital does incredible work to stabilize these two children.
Oh, my God.
And it's really touch and go. And this part of the book is amazing, because just hearing the work these doctors do and the staff and the connection that they feel for these kids, and as well as the police that then arrive on the scene, and just how people getting interviewed by Anne Ruland speaking about how devastating a scene it was, how they're struck by like how, like they'd take Danny's clothes off to go into surgery and they'd like see these teeny tiny 3-year-old shorts covered in blood, and it just like the emotions that would hit you.
Yeah.
All the staff is communicating with Diane, who's, I think they all assume she's in shock because of how weird she's behaving.
Right.
You know, no outward emotion. She sometimes even is laughing or making jokes. She said things to the doctor that operated on Christy. She said, boy, this has really spoiled my vacation. And she also said, that really ruined my new car. It got blood all over the back of it. She's like making jokes about her and hope we have good insurance. Just like very off-putting. And the hospital's like, what happened? And she's like, I don't know. She's like, this man shot my kids. And then later she'll tell the police, this bushy-haired stranger shot my kids and then shot me. And they're like, oh, shot you. And she's like, oh, yeah. And they're like, oh, shit. And she's like, got a bullet in her arm, you know? It's not at all a critical wound and does heal well after surgery. One of the first detectives called to the case, you're just going to have to believe me. It's really unfortunate because this is not a funny case, but his name is Dick Tracy.
I believe you.
I mean,
hold it together. We just...
Dick Tracy, you didn't think you should go by, I don't know, Richard Tracy? I don't know. Go by what you want, Dick. But
live your life,
I'd have made
Tracy.
A different choice.
Yeah. Wow.
Live your life,
Let's
Dick Tracy.
Let's keep moving forward because I have a feeling I know where this is going, but I need confirmation.
So her parents get called to the hospital. She talks to them. She calls her pal. What's his name? Knickerbocker. Mm-hmm. What's his first name? Robert. They called him Lou in the book. And so like she didn't have permission or was helping protect him. So Anne Rule calls him Lou the whole book. So he's always Lou in my head. But his name is Richard Knickerbocker.
Robert.
Fuck. Robert Knickerbocker. She calls him. The first person to question her, though, is Dick Tracy. And she's like, okay, so I was driving home from my friend's house, who I decided to go talk to because I heard a horse was for sale. I wanted to take this scenic way home in the dark after the kids' bedtimes. So I did that. And I was on this drive wanting to go like sightseeing. And then a man jumped out in the middle of the road, waved me down. I pulled over. And he said he wanted my car. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And then he shot all my kids. And then he shot me. And I tried to get away. Basically, I pretended to throw my keys so that he'd turn and go for them. And then I got in the car and I just rushed to the hospital. Her children were shot with a 22. And Diane does own one, according to her husband and others that have seen it. It is not recovered. To all the detectives that hear this story, they just keep saying it's hanky, which means
it's fishy.
It feels wrong.
It's fishy.
It's fishy.
And it's
it
weird.
Feels off. They don't love the – nobody likes a bushy-haired stranger. They even have like a term for it in the police force. That I think they even just call it BHS. No, I think they call it BHS and they're like, oh, a BHS, where it's like, oh, bushy-haired stranger. It's like it's never the bushy-haired stranger.
Oh, interesting.
That's not a thing.
Okay.
Like that's – a made-up thing.
Yeah.
And they're like, why does somebody want to steal a car with three dead kids in it? That doesn't – what it just – sometimes the kids are awake in the stories. Yeah. Sometimes they're asleep. It just – it's – people don't like it. And a witness does end up coming forward that says he drove by her car at the time that it would have been like post-shooting. And it's creeping. Creeping. Creeping.
Oh, God.
It is not rushing. It's creeping. And that's creepy. We don't like that.
No. No.
There's the DA, Fred Hughey, who is listening to all this, getting all this information. He's spending night after night in the hospital watching the kids. He's almost like a guard dog. Like he just has this vibe of like sitting vigil over these children to protect them from who he believes shot them, which is their mother.
Right.
And he's like,
because if they're
I don't
alive,
like this.
They're a liability. They could come if they can say what happened.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And he's like, if this woman really killed her kid, she's going to break soon. There's no way she can like stay in complete control. But he's very wrong. She grows like more controlling, more resolute every day. And he also has this weird phone call with a friend where he doesn't tell the friend any of the details because he doesn't know them yet. And he's like, oh, apparently there was a shooting, these three kids, la, la, la. The mom got shot. And the guy goes, yeah, right. I bet I know exactly where she got shot. And he talks about where she got shot in the arm to not do any damage. And then it ends up being where she was shot. So like that sits really ill with him where he's like, ooh, just by like guessing that this woman was maybe the killer, he guessed exactly where she was shot.
Ooh.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just like, ugh. This guy Welch is on his first homicide case, and he is also, like, immediately suspicious. He talked to Inside Edition about it and said, here was a woman who was completely apathetic about the welfare of her kids. She was just emotionally flat and preoccupied with something else. And he says that the night of the interview was the night of the shooting, and there was just a million problems with the story. They're like, can we search your home? She's like, yes, search my car, search my house, search anything. oh, and by the way, my diaries are here in my house, all my diaries. So like she points out where her diaries are and the diaries feel very stagey.
Oh, God.
They just don't ring true. And also
about
they
to
like
go sightseeing
pivot.
At midnight. Love well, they, the nighttime. Hope I don't get shot. Weird.
Totally. Totally. They super pivot as well, like where it's all about her love for Robert. And then it pivots when you feel like she decided what she was going to do a few weeks prior. It pivots and it becomes all about her kids and how much she loves them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And a few days before the shooting, she buys a unicorn and gets it inscribed with all of their names, which is just, if you knew her, very we'd weird behavior. Be, yeah, we, it oh feels God. Like she's like making a little gravestone for them. It's like an in memoriam
no,
kind of
she's,
vibes.
It's not even that. She's trying to paint herself as a doting, caring mother and knowing that she's right. going to murder her children. That's it's not a grave yeah. site. It's she's trying to go, look how much I cared about them. If I bought them this. It also feels so sad to
over
me.
Over the top. So presentational.
So presentational where it feels so sad to me that it's this is what caring for your kid feels like.
What a good mom does is get a unicorn inscribed. And
exactly.
you're like,
and it's like,
or just
or
don't
shows
hit
up,
them.
Or just
would
shows
so
up.
Good.
Shows up for them.
Yeah.
That's so
well,
dark.
They keep delaying. What they end up doing is they don't rush to trial. They delay trial a lot. And they delay it because Christy and Danny are alive. And Danny's so young, but Christy's 8. And they have this thought of like,
maybe should
can
she
Christy can. Get well enough physically and psychologically to testify about that night? But meanwhile, Diana's totally off scot-free. She's calling Robert and still wooing him and...
They're,
you know,
they got to be tracking her shit. I think they got. I think it's so powerful that.
Oh,
she,
they are. Yeah. He helps them. He even
of
says if
does.
You want to. He's. They're like, yeah, let's record her calls, which he then does, and then she finds out he's recording the calls, and that's like a final straw for her, where it's like, fuck you, dude, because. Of course, the only reason he wants to talk to her is to try to help the police. He yeah. doesn't want to talk to no. her, and so, she. Meanwhile, we're trying to get Christy better. She's seeing a therapist. And one thing the therapist will do with her is be like, why don't you write down on a slip of paper who shot you? And at the end of the session, you're going to burn it in the fireplace in my office. And that feels like safe for her because yeah. you can imagine how scary it all is. And she's doing that kind of stuff over and over again. She's in an amazing foster care home of this family that took in tons of foster kids, mm-hmm. not tons like where their house is full, but over and over had helped the
kids,
state in this
yeah.
way. They're very good at what they do. They're very patient. They're very safe. They're very, and she and Danny are together there. One day when she's in therapy.
How do they justify that she's not with their mother? If their mother isn't charged with anything, how do they justify her going into foster?
She's under suspicion. Like she is, it's a known suspect. And so I
okay.
think that
so
I'm
not
sure
totally
what those legal
free,
terms
she's,
are.
Okay, gotcha.
She's not, all I'm saying is she's not awaiting trial right, in prison.
Right. She's not been charged
and she doesn't,
the crime.
And she only has, she's not allowed to see the kids right now.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And which is like
good for her. She's probably
before
stoked.
This all happened. She was in the hospital. She was allowed to see them. And you'd watch her go in and like whisper in Christy's ear and be like, what you whispering, Diane? What the fuck? It's so scary. And they would talk about Christy, her mood changing in the hospital and feeling better. And then Diane would walk in and like whisper things to her and leave. And Christy would look like so
oh,
scared.
My God.
Can you imagine?
That's
it's like so sad. And the foster family says when Christy came into their home, it was crazy because she was 8 years old, but she thought it was her responsibility to do the family laundry and cook and to babysit Danny. And they were like, oh, no.
Poor girl.
And she's having all these nightmares. And the longer she's away from her mom, the less the nightmares happen. She never asks for her mother or like anything about her mom, which is very unusual for an 8-year-old. And she starts to really trust her foster parents. She starts to really trust Fred Hughie, who's totally a presence in her life. And she starts to trust her therapist to a point where when she's writing the name, she'll let him keep it in a sealed envelope, not read it. But she doesn't always have to have him burn it. So then
and he's
she,
just collecting these and he's not reading mm-hmm. it. He's oh my God, the patience.
So then there's this huge setback where we're watching her get better, better, better. And then her dad does have visitation and gets to take her and Danny out. And one day he takes them out and he lets Diane see her. And no. Diane takes Christy away, like goes and spends like a day alone with her, which is really scary. And we're so lucky nothing happened to her. But you can imagine when she came back, all those people, Fred Hughie, the foster family, they were like, oh, well, there's a marked difference. Happened. She clamped down, like she shut down. And it's like starting from square one again.
This poor little girl.
Meanwhile, they're trying to get, because it's, they don't want the case to rest on Christy.
No.
So they're trying to find anything they can. And there's some pretty big clues, which is to say there's no blood splatter on the interior or exterior of the driver's side where Diane would have been, which if the struggle she described happened, you would have seen that. Because police believe what happened is she shot herself away from the car and got rid of the gun before she took the kids to the hospital. They can't get the gun. They can't get the – they can't prove that the bullets came from her gun, which would have been, like, huge, but they really can't do it. So what happens eventually is that they do go to trial. It's been a year, basically, since this all went down. And Christy's – not in good shape. She doesn't have full mobility in her arm, and nor the stroke that she had also has made it so that her face slumps and her speaking is a bit impaired. Danny, again, is paralyzed. After months and months of going through therapy, she's able to try to describe what happened that night. She tells the detectives that she did not see a man the night she was shot, that she remembers who shot her, and that it was her mom. She says that her mom stopped the car, walked to the trunk, got something out, reached in the window, and shot she and her siblings. She said that the whole time it was happening, the song Hungry Like the Wolf was playing.
Oh my God.
And they play it in court. It's so crazy because they play the song in court to be like, this is about like a woman that wanted a man. This is about a woman that wanted to be with a man that didn't want kids, and what she would do, like what lengths she would go to try to get him. And while they play it in court, Diane is like bopping to the music, like smiling and like toe tapping. She's like from outer space. There's just no connection. You're just like, on the one hand, she can be so calculating, and on the other, be a complete fool and to not see. Oh, I should mention, she's pregnant during the trial. She like ran and got pregnant from a guy right before the trial started. And it feels like she did it in a calculated way. And it, and she like talks about how she can't replace the child that died, but like she can replace that love in her life. And so she's like very pregnant during this trial.
Oh my God.
And like tapping her fingers on her stomach during the trial.
She's like the definition of a narcissist, right? Like she just wants all these. Ugh.
Yeah, it's so alarming. And
that's so scary. So heartbreaking.
And it's like she wanted to be on the stand pregnant, because how does that look? This woman saying, it wasn't me, it was this man, I'm a victim, and she's pregnant. I don't know. It's all it's very interesting. But one of the things she's going to have to contend with in the trial is how many times she changed her story. Because we did Bushy-Haired Stranger, but then we did, this was like a plot that my husband made with somebody and I know them, but I can't say who they are. These were two men that were masked and they knew that I had a tattoo and they knew my name. And she changes the story like a million times. So it's pretty crazy when she has to take the stand, which she does to try to deal with that.
It's crazy that she agrees to take the stand, or that her attorney lets her take the stand. She'd be like the worst person to take the stand.
Yeah, because she also is like a chatty Cathy. So she gets herself in trouble because she'll talk and talk and talk. But I think that they want her to talk about like the abuse that she suffered at the hands of her father, and like how she's a victim, and how she wrote a paper about abuse all about like stopping the cycle of abuse, which is also really interesting, because the prosecution uses that to be like, so you were abused, and then
you did it.
You did the exact thing that you said abused people do. You did it. And she's like, I stopped the cycle of abuse. And he goes, by killing your children? It's like, oh, is that how you stopped it?
It just doesn't
Diane?
Make sense. It's like, okay, are you saying she's not guilty? And here's the proof of like, because otherwise it's like not guilty by reasons of insanity and that she wasn't of sound mind. And that's why the abuse, right. Like it feels like they're fighting a different battle. They're fighting a different battle for her.
It's really wild, but her attorney has like the hardest job ever because
yeah.
She is so unaffected and hearing the hospital staff go up and be like, she didn't shed a tear. She made a joke. Like, and I know we talk about how you don't know how you would act, but it's over and over again, this woman. And then she talks about how, well, my father raised me in this way that was like, you don't show emotion, you never cry. So basically everything comes down to like character analysis because they don't have the evidence necessarily to prove that it was her. But then also you have Christy, and Christy's the main component for the prosecution because they say to her, do you still love your mom after she said her mom did it? And she goes, yeah. The therapist on the stand is like, we played hungry like the wolf for her. The memories of the night came like flooding back to her. I had her make lists of people who are safe and who aren't safe. And the people on the list of who are not safe, she wrote mom, maybe dad. And he brought out the sealed envelopes. And he's like, explained what they were. They are dated and they're months and months apart from each other. And they're months away from this court date. And he opens them and they both say, mom. Like, who shot you?
That
your mom.
Poor little girl.
He also testifies, or the foster parents, I think, testify to this, that they heard Danny say to Christy, we might get shot again. And Christy said, no, we won't, because our mom doesn't know the address of the foster parents. So it's like,
oh my God.
They're literally thinking these little kids are like, our mom might try to kill us. And it's like, no, I think we'll be safe. It's so heartbreaking. And Fred Hughey, who is the prosecutor in the case, is so gentle and sweet with Christy. He cares so much about her. He knows how hard this is for her. And her mother's in the room, don't forget.
Oh my God.
And he's just like so like stops when she needs to stop. He doesn't push. He's really like, he wants Diane behind bars, but he's not going to do it at the detriment of making Christy it's so hard for her. He just like, you feel the love in the room. And then obviously the defense, it does not has like this job to do, but like they do a bad job, which is to say the guy is asking really long, twisty, confusing questions to a point where jurors are whispering to each other, stop, stop. Like they just don't want him to even see this. Cause it's like, leave her alone. And so they're kind of turning against the defense. Yeah. She is found guilty.
Shocking.
I know. And then her sentencing has to be delayed so she can give birth. And
child.
The TV
who's going to be
a TV reporter says she knew that if she got pregnant, people would look at her and say, how could a woman who loves children this much have killed their children? And Diane is like, oh, I got pregnant because I miss Christy and I miss Danny and I miss Cheryl so much. I'm never going to see Cheryl on earth again. And I just, you can't replace children, but you can replace the effect they give you. And they give me love. They give me satisfaction. They give me a reason to live and a reason to be happy. When she gives birth to this little girl, the little girl is, she names her, I think, Amy. Anyway, she's given to adoptive parents who name her Becky Babcock. And Becky has written about learning who her biological mother is. Meantime, time to sentence. Diane Downs is sentenced to life plus 50 years in prison. She maintains her innocence and goes to jail at Oregon Women's Correctional Facility. On July 11th of 1987, all the women go out to the yard for their like –
mm-hmm.
Recess. I don't know. I don't think it's called that.
No, it is. It is.
Okay.
Outdoor
recess
time.
And Diane goes over to this table at the edge of the yard to get sun, which she always did. The fences are 18 feet high. They have razor wire on top. And there is an outer fence with an alarm. But the outer fence is super sensitive, where if like a bird lands on it, the alarm goes off. So if the wind blows, the alarm goes off. So Diane is going toward her usual bench that day, and she walks by two prisoners, Louise and Gretchen, and she says to them, "I'm going now." And they don't turn to watch her because they don't know if she's serious, but they don't want to be in charge of reporting anything. She looks pretty big that day. She's wearing a lot of clothes, Diane, a lot of clothes. They hear a clanking noise, like someone has climbed the fence, and then they hear over the alarm system, check zone one. And Louise turns and sees Diane's made it over the fence, but she also sees a guard patrolling the wall who she is pretty sure has seen Diane. The guard has not. Meanwhile, the prisoners go back inside and a piano happens to fall on an inmate, and that's like a wild thing. So they're dealing with this. It's a ruckus. It's a distraction. The alarm's gone off, but no one saw anything, and the alarm is sensitive. So it takes a minute. Somebody arrives in the parking lot at this time, sees someone that they think looks like Diane Downs crawling out from under a car. And they're like, what was that? They go in, the count's off. Diane is already hitchhiking. A woman gives her a ride and is like, where do you want to go? And Diane is being super sketchy and is like, I want to go to the plaid pantry. No, I want to go to the pizza parlor. You're like, okay, what's up? And she's like, my boyfriend's hurt. I need to get to him. I don't know where he is. I got to help him. When she gets out of the car, she just like runs off. The woman's like, that was weird. And that woman looked like Diane Downs, who I know is in prison. So she calls the prison and is like, kind of think I just
person looks like?
She was all over the news. The Diane Downs story was everywhere. So she's like, I feel like I just had Diane Downs in my car. I know it's not possible because she's in prison.
Why would you stop and pick anyone up like that right outside the prison? She's wearing an orange jumpsuit. Super bizarre.
Well, she wasn't. She had her clothes on, and then she had her second layer of clothes on so that she could ditch clothes as she went and change her appearance as she was fleeing.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Hughie gets the call. And they're like, Hughie, Diane, you know, she's been in jail 3 years, but she's just not there anymore. And this is alarming to him for obvious reasons that I'm sure you can imagine.
Where are the children? Hide them.
I'm so glad you asked where the children are. They've been adopted by Fred Hughie. Can you believe the prosecutor and his wife adopted them? So not only is he worried about the children, they're his children. And so I was so relieved because I was like, I feel like somebody that really cares about these kids that's a tough nut to crack is like watching over them. And a guy that's like,
and it's him.
Oh, hell no. It's him. So he's like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? My main thing is like, he's like going to like get his gun and sit on his porch all night vibes.
That's the only newbie I can get behind.
They're also calling Charlene and
Robert. They're like, Robert, she's coming for you.
They're like, you guys might be. Yeah. And they're like, oh, Diane, who knows? You know who else gets freaked out?
Her husband?
Anne Rule, because she's already written this book. And the book is very like, Diane did it. And Diane did not like the book. She was very vocal about that. And never has Anne Rule felt so freaked out. And she writes about all kinds of people. Woman was friends with Ted Bundy. She doesn't blanch easy, I don't imagine. And she was freaked out. She was like,
this woman's gonna
just do see a world where Diane would come for me.
If someone tries to kill their children, it's game over. There's nothing standing in their way.
There's no line.
There's no line. A stranger makes it all that easier, frankly.
But Hughie's really close to this prison because, remember, they're in Oregon as well. So he's like, I can totally see a world where she's going to try to come for Danny or for Christy. I'm so freaked out. And the search just goes on for days and days and days. She could be anywhere at this point because they know she hitched. So they're in her cell trying to figure out any clues that she's left behind. And they hold her stationary up to light and they see indentations. And they're so slight, they have to take it to a lab to figure out what did she write. And there's a map on it with PP. And remember, she was like, plaid pantry. No, pizza parlor. An address that is 2 blocks from where she got out of the car she hitchhiked in is marked. They go to that house. A man opens the door. And it seems to be like a boarding situation. Like there's a few boarders there. Mm-hmm. And they see a guy look nervous in the background. They go in and they find Diane and this guy, Wayne Seifer, in one of the back rooms. Notable, Wayne Seifer is the husband of Louise, the woman that was in prison that saw Diane escape. That's her husband.
Whoa.
Yeah. And the other men in the boarding house are all in trouble, of course, for like keeping her there. But they're like, well, she just seemed like a nice lady that needed our help. That's not Wayne's story. Wayne is like, I'm in love with her. I absolutely am in love with her. They've definitely.
Poor Louise.
I think she probably tried to get pregnant.
Poor Louise.
Knowing her, she was trying to get pregnant while she was gone. Louise is heartbroken.
Yeah.
Louise is devastated. Ugh. Diana's recaptured. She's transferred to the New Jersey Department of Corrections, which is only happens because of some pretty heavy lifting and lobbying from Hughie, because he's like, get her across the fucking continent. Like, get her away from these kids, because people do escape prison, and I just want I don't want her anywhere near these kids. She gets diagnosed, by the way, throughout all this.
They finally have some diagnosis
time that they're able to talk to her. Narcissistic, mm-hmm. histrionic, and antisocial personality disorders. She's got a triptych.
She's got it all.
She's got it all, baby. She's been denied parole 3 times, most recently in 2020. She still maintains her innocence. After this case, Dick Tracy has retired since and become a PI.
Hmm.
So now he's private eye Dick Tracy. Very cool.
Let's hire him for all our needs. Let's do it. That feels right.
I told you that Becky Babcock was adopted. She's a behavioral health coordinator for children in Salem, Oregon. She also breeds dogs.
Oh.
Both Christy and Danny graduated from college. Christy still suffers from a speech disability.
Mm-hmm.
She has a son and a daughter, and she named her daughter Cheryl in memory of
her sister
that died. And we don't know a lot about Danny. We know he's a computer whiz. We know that he is partially paralyzed from the bullet that his mother fired into his body.
Would you know where he's paralyzed?
It's partial. I think it's waist down.
Gotcha.
But we do know that they both were really happy growing up in the Hughies' home. And yeah, that's the story of Diane Downs. May she rot in hell.
May she rot in hell and stay in prison. Just stay there. How long was her sentence?
Life plus 50.
Get it. Wow. Let's take a break. Well, I actually I'm really cold in here. I'm going to go grab a sweatshirt and I'll be right back. Okay. Here we go. The good news about my story is it's not as dark. So I feel like we are going to end on a positive note. I actually got this story from one source and one source only, and you're going to love it. It's truly adventurous.
Woo!
So I want to talk to you about Alma Nelson. Alma Nelson is a mystic, and she's really in operation in the 1920s, right? So she's like coming up in the 1920s. We know because we've covered spiritualism in many ways. We've interviewed spiritualist experts in our previous life as Lifetime podcast hosts. But just like a brief recap, after World War, which one, Quinn?
Wait.
After World War
One.
Is it because I held my hand up like this that you guessed that?
No. No. I know the other one's later.
The other one is later. I love it. Quinn, we're learning. We're growing. After World War One, spiritualists and mystics gained a lot of popularity. Obviously, a lot of people lost loved ones, lost people during the war. And so it became a way to speak to them after they were gone. And this, like we've talked about, whether it's, is it real? Are these people mediums? Or is it like collective PTSD that people are communing? Mm-hmm. Or, which we're going to find out, some of it just might be frauds. Or are they? We don't know. Alma Nelson, it's in the 1920s, and she actually co-founded a congregation as part of the First Spiritualist Church of New York. And she worked alongside this guy, Arthur Ford, who is a charismatic young minister. And they were so hot to trot that on Sunday nights, they would have like a seance, like a service at Carnegie Hall. What a get. Huge. Amazing. So it's like 300 people would come to Carnegie Hall to watch her like under a trance. And so one night she was like under a trance and she was like, oh, I'm looking for Sudha. And all of a sudden this woman like stands up and stops her and is like, you are the worst, and I am accusing you of inappropriate relationships with Arthur Ford, that young charismatic minister. And so she's in there being like, I was just about to get into my shit and like commune with spirits, and this bitch is like talking smack and like, Arthur, are you gonna stand up for me? And Arthur's like, you know what, I'm gonna sit this one out. And she's like, nice. The fuck?
Rude.
So I don't know if they had an inappropriate relationship, but everybody thought she did. And in this article, it basically was like she got like outed in this massive stage. She's a woman, obviously, so that doesn't help. It's the 1920s. And like kind of has to slink back into the recesses of the shadows of the spiritualist community and is like sort of like Avita Zend out. Okay. So This is in the 1920s. The Great Depression hits. Okay. And she has not returned to the church. But she is struggling financially along with the rest of the world, right? I mean, it's the Great Depression. They don't call it because people were having a good time. So while she's trying to get by, she's working as a waitress in this building called the Ansonia, which is in Manhattan. And that's actually where she lived as well. And it like really reminds me of the Arconia from Only Murders in the Building. But the Ansonia is what they refer to as the bohemian stepchild of the city. In fact, what's interesting, just like a tidbit about this, is that the architect, after designing this like crazy gothic, like just... He combined two architectural types. You don't need to know what it is, but apparently after he designed it, he was institutionalized. So there's some creepy things happening at the Ansonia, but it also has a restaurant in there and apartments. And Alma Nelson was like, yeah, I'm going to do both of those things. It also saw a lot of like bad celebrity behavior. It had mobsters, bookies, and there was at least one bank robber that lived there. But it just was like bohemian stepchild of the city. So she's waitressing. She's also like back to her old mystic stuff. She's like, I know what's up. Let's see what happens. So she's a mystic. She's seeing clients in there and she works with her clients on mystic philosophy and electrotherapeutics in her home. So again, it's the Great Depression. I think especially after the war, the Great Depression comes, people are like looking for answers. And they're looking for answers in all the wrong places. So she, as a medium, as a mystic, she has like these guides in the spirit world. And we've talked often about how sometimes they are Native American people. Sometimes they're like Persians. And just as an anecdote that this article highlighted was there was a study done where they took a bunch of mystics or mediums and they process their heartbeats, or they like study their heartbeats when they would be like in contact with their guides. And they noticed consistently that the heartbeats changed. So they were like, something does happen in the body when these mystics or spiritualists commune with the spirit world. So again, like it's just an interesting study. So introducing in this moment, a model by the name of Helen Ressler. Now, again, it's 1935 and Helen is 28. years old, and she's a model, and more specifically, she's a hand model.
Cool.
Really cool. And they actually like talk about her hands. They're like perfectly portioned. Have you seen?
So nice to be a hand model. So lazy.
So lazy. But also, have you seen that video? You have to have, of the woman who's a hand model who's insane. It's like an early 2000s interview from YouTube. And it's this woman.
I've not seen this.
Oh my gosh, I have to describe it to you. If you've seen it, write in, because it's my favorite. It's this woman who is like fully wearing gloves and doesn't touch anything, because she's like, a paper cut is a career ruiner for me. And she's talking like this the whole time, and she's talking about like a seductive versus a housewife like a glove. And she's just like, really,
could you take yourself seriously?
She takes herself so really seriously, and it's so good. And her hands, she's like, it's perfectly moisturized. And she'll be at a Broadway show and she will not open the door for herself. She can't risk hurting the instruments.
What if she breaks a nail?
I mean, I don't know. We watched Friends. Do you remember when they had a hand model? When was it Joey who was going to hand model or something?
Yes.
And then he or was it, was Chandler or was something. It was Joey who was going to hand model. And then he could have hit it big. Anyway, so back to Helen Ressler. She's a hand model. And at the time, it's 1935. Huge, obviously, much of America is without a job. But she not only has a job as a young woman, she is also making money. She's selling gloves, lotions, all the things. And so she wants to see what's up with the spiritual world. And so she heads up to the Ansonia and she goes to Alma Nelson's apartment and she's going to attend one of the weekly truth sittings in Alma's apartment. So Helen walks in and she meets another guy who's there. This guy's name is Arthur Lingelbach. And he's this 86-year-old guy. And he's like, hey, listen, I'm this engineer. And he's like, talking to her about all this cool stuff he did. He's like, yeah, no, I actually helped Thomas Edison finish the phonograph. It's super crazy. And Arthur has been a longtime client of Alma. And So the three of them are together and it is seance time. So
whoop, whoop,
whoop, whoop, boom, shakalaka. Boom, shakalaka. It's time. The lights are dimmed. I'm sure there's candles. And so Alma is sitting there and she's kind of like bobbing and weaving in her chair and like meeting a bunch of spirits, right? And then all of a sudden, boom, she is possessed by Suda, the guy she tried to summon when that lady called her out. So Suda enters Alma's body and she's like, listen, this is Suda, the son of the solitude of the lost Isle of Atlantis.
Whoa, very long name.
What a get. What a get. Buoy for us. So if you don't know about Atlantis, where have you been? But Atlantis, as we know, is like an advanced civilization. Like it was like peak civilization. It's like this mystical place, or is it real, where they had all of these like cool technological advances and then it was just like washed away by the ocean. And it was this civilization that was super advanced. And what's important to note is that at the time of the Great Depression, everything was like sad and depressing and dour. Atlantis became this like alluring, technological, advanced place where like people just looked up to. So Suda is like working through Alma and Suda is telling Helen and Arthur about his amazing life in Atlantis, and he's talking about his remarkable brother. And his brother has this soul that has just gone through many different life forms, right? So a little bit about his brother. He was an Egyptian nobleman who supervised the building of the Great Pyramids, which is a big deal because, as we know, the pyramids are like an architectural mystery. Like, how did they build the pyramids? How did they get there? Which my favorite thing to ask you is, do you know why the pyramids are still in Egypt?
Do I know why?
Do you know why?
Well, you can't fucking move them.
Because the British couldn't move them. So Suda's brother, he's like this engineering whiz. Like, he's a big deal. He's this big kahuna spirit soul that is like finding ways, that is traveling, right, among big moments in time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been reborn many, many, many times. And Suda is like constantly looking for his brother. And you're never going to believe it. You're never going to believe it, Quinn. Guess what?
Tell me.
His brother's spirit is in New York at that moment.
No.
Do you know who it is? It's this crazy thing, because what a coinkydink.
Alfred Bloomingdale. No, who?
His sibling soul, his brother's soul, is in New York City, and would you believe it? It is in the body of 86-year-old by the name of Arthur Lingelbach. By Arthur Lingelbach, the guy who's sitting right next to Helen, who apparently helped Thomas Edison with the phonograph.
The coincidence is just too unbelievable.
It's insane. It's so crazy. And so Helen must have felt shell-shocked and starstruck. And she was sitting here next to that guy. And Suda is like working through Alma being like, trust him. You will gather great wealth. So after the seance, Arthur essentially is like, that's so crazy. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. So this is like a timeshare gone wrong. So he's like, tells her that he's worked. Do you know
which
what
always
I mean?
Goes wrong?
Like free lunch, yeah. And then you get in, you're like, oh my god, I have to give you money. So Arthur tells her that he like worked at General Electric. He designed frontline trenches that saved a bunch of soldiers in World War I. Teddy Roosevelt actually tapped him to work on the Panama Canal because of his engineering skills. He actually had blueprints with him. He goes, why wouldn't you carry that around to a seance for inventions he wanted to create? And
I love that.
The thing that was hard was like, he did need some more money, company called Super Utilities.
Wouldn't you not invest at this point?
It's, if the spirit world is telling you, he wanted to invent some of the inventions. He wanted to invent a airplane that went 2,000 miles an hour, a refrigerator that had perpetual motion physics so that you wouldn't have to, it wouldn't require energy, a Super U wave machine, which was a therapeutic device that healed with esoteric energies. And he actually also had an invention for an advanced TV. I don't know if it was considered a smart TV, but it was an advanced TV. So Helen is in there. I think like the patchouli is hitting the nose. And she's like, you know what? I have money. I do want to invest. When you make money, you want to use the money to make more money. So Helen invests $1,000, which in today's money is $19,000, in Super Utilities. And then she does the thing that's going to get them even more money. She starts bringing in her friends and referrals. So she's bringing her friends to Alma's apartment, and this company rises to the equivalent of $9.4 million. Like, they get enough of they're like, they're hitting it big. They're doing great. And so Helen is there, and she's like bringing her friends. She's super stoked. She's like, you got to meet this friend. You got to meet this woman. You got to meet this company. You got to invest. It's amazing. It's so cool. And every time Helen was like, okay, so can you show me the machines that you've invented? I'd love to see. Do you have any returns? What's the deal? But he did what anyone does. He stalls. He doesn't have them. He can't see the machines, you know, and as the company is growing and Helen is attending more of these seances, she's like, wow, it's like getting really similar and almost like a script. And holy shit, I think I got God. So she's like, oh no, what do I do? Mm-hmm. And already being a woman, you're vulnerable. And also you like got duped by a seance. This is really uncomfortable. So she meets with the Attorney General, John J. Bennett Jr., which is a great name, John J. Bennett Jr.
Yeah.
And when she tells her story, he's actually very respectful and he's not at all judgmental, which go him. And from there, she signs a complaint and she goes from an investor to a whistleblower. The papers then find out, and the newspaper headlines read things like seance stock scheme or sells by sorcery or glove model upset. She invests in master and complains of no dividends. So they're going to trial and she's the main star witness. And because they're like, this couple is a fraud. They're committing fraud. And in her testimony, it's this really challenging line because she's trying to be seen as credible and not gullible and irresponsible. And that's hard because she's a woman at the time. And also it is spiritualism. And it's Helen v. Alma. And you know what? Alma ain't going down without a fight. And what happens is
that's our Alma.
That's our Alma girl. In a twist that nobody sees coming, Alma presents new evidence in the trial. This evidence is a petition that is signed by 300 of her Super Utility stockholders. And what's crazy about
God, I thought you were going to say ghosts.
I think we've seen that before.
Do you know how many
before.
Ghosts sign this petition?
But what's crazy is these people that invested in Super Utilities signed this petition that, and they're like, we're outraged that you'd accuse this woman of fraud. She's amazing. How dare you? And essentially the prosecution is like, wait a minute, wait. We thought we had this case where you were committing fraud against these people. And now these people are writing us being like, we're good. And it's like the case completely falls apart because they no longer have victims, because the victims are like, we're not victims.
Right.
Super strange. So the judge, like, their hands are tied. And so they're like, we're going to prohibit Arthur from selling stocks and we're going to prohibit Alma from advising on money matters in these truth sittings. Basically, like, poor Helen. But Helen does have like, a bit of a good little outcome because as much as like these people got away with her money scot-free, all these newspaper articles about like how she was an amazing glove model – like basically was like free advertising, and they like went into, they like talked about how beautiful her hands were and how proportional they were. So her modeling career just like boomed after this moment. And so she found, like, she wanted to get a lot of success and, hell, made a lot more money. So you might be wondering, is this fraud or is this real? So this is an interesting thing where a couple years ago, there was this clip from 1928 that came out and it went viral. It was this moment of this woman in this, like, fur coat walking in 1928 footage, and she's holding this, like, black rectangle to her ear. Okay. And, like, okay, what do you think that looks like?
A phone.
A phone. And it's weird because there's a video and she's, like, talking into this black device and it looks like a phone. And so it goes viral and everybody's, like, holding it. Like, what's going on? Is she holding a phone? And to make it even more bizarre, the woman in the video is the same build and appearance as Alma Nelson. What's fascinating, okay, is, like I said, this petition came out that stopped the case, but all these other people invested in super utilities, nobody else ever came forward. No, mm-hmm, other investors cried fraud and tried to get their money back. And what's even crazier is all of these inventions that Arthur said was going to come to fruition did eventually come to fruition. And so there is this, like, little fun conspiracy theory ending where Alma, with the help of Suda and the brother, was there time travel, and did she have a cell phone in 1928? Oh my
God. I love this. I love this so much. Yes. Yes.
But what's crazy is, like, Helen is the whistleblower, but nobody else. They all just, like, invested money and I never said anything about it. Maybe they were embarrassed, or maybe they're all bajillionaires now. Move over Silicon
that
Valley. We
so
have Suda's brother.
Crazy.
Yeah.
What?
So that's the
what
story.
A story. What do you think? What do you think?
I mean, the her talking like this is so weird. It's weird.
That's so weird.
But I don't know. The idea of her being like, oh, this, what a coincidence. This guy is sitting right
Maybe
next to you.
Maybe she hurt her jaw and she had an ice pack that she was talking
How did
to.
They keep the, maybe the ice pack is that perpetual for refrigeration Arthur was talking about, in which case also an inventor. I just love the idea of this 86-year-old man during the Great Depression being like, we got to get some money. Let's figure out. Like, he's 86 in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at this point, what have you got to lose, guy?
Sure.
Anyway, so that's the story. At least we ended in a positive note.
I love it. Okay, well,
this is the world's longest episode. Thank you for being here. Hey, subscribe, join Patreon. I love you. Tell your friends you love them. And if you're overwhelmed, take a little meditation. We love you. Goodbye.